Hello, I'm Mariëtte Snyman. Welcome to Calm, Clear and Helpful, a weekly podcast series on taking good care of yourself and others, introducing you to wellness professionals and courageous individuals ready to inform and inspire. Today's topic is coming to terms with stage 4 incurable bone cancer. My guest is Mandy Gwen Mulders, speaking from Fishhook. Welcome, Mandy.
Hello, Marie. Thank you.
Thank you for talking to us about your journey with breast cancer and now with stage 4 bone cancer. I know, Mandy, you have so much to share, and I have so much to ask that we'll only touch the tip of the iceberg today, but you do have a wonderful blog where listeners can read about your journey and your poems. And we'll mention the link during our conversation, and I'll ask you to end our conversation with one of your poems.
That sounds good. Thank you.
Before we start, I'd like to thank clinical social worker Morag Skordelis from Cape Town because she introduced me to you and she treats you by using brainworking recursive therapy. We'll get to that too in the course of our discussion. Now, Mandy, you were diagnosed with breast cancer, which then spread so that you're now living with stage 4 bone cancer. Could you start by telling us a little more about yourself?
Yes, I think just to encapsulate the whole life, really, as I started, you know, all my first 21 years was in a family that was strongly anchored in religion and discipline. My dad was a reverend. We were strongly linked to Afrikaans heritage, so I'm bilingual, and we had a pretty traumatic upbringing, and my parents were extremely young. Anyway, I was very, very, very thrilled and happy to run away literally at 21 and get married, you know. And so I left that and jumped into a marriage of 25 years, which was extremely social and busy. And I had children and we were skiing and we were doing all sorts of things. And I was doing the Argus and we were swimming the Midmar. And that was, you know, that busyness of little children, bringing them up, taking them to school, boarding school, organizing all of that. But after 25 years, I just decided I felt so uncomfortable in my skin and I just needed to know who I was. And so I left the marriage and I started out alone in Pretoria. So I'd been in Pretoria for 9 years before I came to Fishhook.
Yes. And where were you when you were married? Where were you living then?
We were living in the Free State. And, yeah, so we took advantage of the Sterkfontein Dam and we were skiing and my children went to school in Natal. Mm. So they were weekly boarders, you know, over from Rhiannon. Every week I'd take them to boarding school. And then when they all left, they did their gap years in London, all of them, and they all went off to study. So for now, I mean, I have 3 married adults and 4 grandchildren, so I am extremely blessed.
Yes. So you went from the Free State to Pretoria and
yes,
and now you're in Cape Town. Could you give us a brief overview of your life before you were diagnosed with breast cancer?
Sure. Mariëtte, those were the years, the 9 years in Pretoria, really, because the breast cancer happened just after I got to Fishhook. So in those 9 years in Pretoria, I was a Pilates instructor. I was giving lessons for hours on a day, often doing 3, 4, 5 lessons with my clients. I was doing big group lessons. I was absolutely loving it. Of course, I was dating. I had stopped drinking 4 years prior to leaving the marriage, and I finally stopped smoking after doing some hypnotherapy. I was healthy. I was strong. I was extremely physical, and I started to explore esoteric models of healing. Because obviously there were things to root out. And I went on quite a mission of trying to root out these hurts and emotional pains. And so I was having a lot of fun caring for just myself. And then 2 years later, after 9 years in Pretoria, I left. And I went on a road trip and I landed up in Fishhook, where then I had found out I had the breast cancer.
Was it difficult to move from Pretoria to Fishhoek? I mean, you had established yourself in Pretoria and now suddenly you were in Fishhoek.
I tell you what happened is, and I have seen this pattern throughout my life, I'm an up and runner. So when I feel a little bit too claustrophobic, well, I run. And so literally I escaped to 21, jumped into a marriage. You know, when the marriage got too tight, I jumped and I went to Pretoria. And that's exactly what happened in Pretoria. I just wasn't coping. I'd just been going through my divorce. I was surviving. I was in survival mode and I was paying the rent. And for the first time in my life, I was responsible for my financial income and I bought a flat. I was gardening my own garden. So I was really pushing and I was in survival mode most of that time. And eventually it became such a tight hairball. I just decided I had to get out of here. And one of my friends actually said to me, Mandy, it feels to me like you're running. And I said, no. But after the fact, when I look back, I see this was my habit, you know.
And then you were in Fishhoek where the breast cancer came up.
Right. So when I got to Fishhoek, I decided, right, I'm going to change a little bit tack again. And I found an admin job. And I had had the breast lump for the whole of the Pretoria 9 years. I'd had it by Opseed. I'd been to a brand new doctor in Pretoria. We had the biopsy done and he said, it's benign. So I didn't worry about it. But the lump grew. Mm. I kept ignoring it. I went back to my doctor again just for a checkup. I said, it's benign. And he said to me, why am I on estrogen? And I said, well, you know, I had a hysterectomy when I was 30 and I went straight on to hormone replacement. So I had been taking estrogen for 20 years. Anyway, in Fishhoek, I woke up one morning and I just realized that I had an inverted nipple and the side of my breast was inverted and pulling in. And I got a huge shock. It was horrible to see. And although my children had been asking me, please, please, please to look at it, I had just flatly denied anything was happening. So I felt very, very shocked. And I made a few calls from work about getting a mammogram. The mammogram had become so expensive. Anyway, the lady just said to me, you know, this is fine because you get a mammogram every 2 years on the hospital plan. So that was a relief. And I went to the radiographer and she was shocked. She just stared at me and I said to her, please, please don't judge me. I said, I know there's nothing I can do. I'm here now. And she just said, why have you left it for so long? How long has it been? And, you know, it was literally six years. I felt very ashamed, but she was so kind. She could see that I was really felt terrible. And she actually took it upon herself to call me on her private cell phone the minute she knew the news. And, of course, it was cancer. Mm. So she referred me to a general surgeon after the CT scan. And he just said to me, look, the whole lot's going to come up. You know, you can't save the nipple. You can't save the skin. Everything was attached and it all had to come off. So I said to him, well, you know what I think I would do is I would take both breasts. And he said, no, but you've got one healthy breast. And I just, you know, to me now to go back for mammos on a healthy breast and it's breast tissue, I just said to him, I actually can't. I don't have the emotional strength or I just felt like I could not do that. And I said to him, I want you to literally amputate as close to my pec muscles as possible to get the flattest result. He just looked at me. He was quite shocked. And he said, you know, are you not in shock? And I said, no. I said, you know that every woman, I think, thinks about the day that this may happen. And I had probably been thinking about it in the back of my mind, knowing this lump was growing and growing and growing and sort of pushing it away. And he wasn't too happy. And he said, all right, I'll tell you what I'll do is you first go and see a breast surgeon and you speak to the breast surgeon about your options. And I had known about the options. I mean, they were lat flaps. You can take in lats and you can twist them round to the front to give yourself a soft, you know, bulge. And you can do all sorts of things, and you can have spaces and you can have prosthetics and what have you. And it just wasn't for me. So I'd been to the breast surgeon and I came back and I just said, no. I said, you know what? I'm going to be very comfortable with absolutely nothing. And I said to him, if you think of it this way, maybe you would agree more with me. I'm going to have a chest piece, a big tattoo on my chest. And it sort of, that made more sense, you know. And I said to him, please, 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 that's what I would love. Is I haven't got the finances to go back for prosthetics and implants and spaces and all that. I said, you know, that's not part of my life. And I begged him to do it. So he motivated for the right side to come off. And I actually said to him, if he didn't get it right, that I would pay for the right side to come off as well. So I had a full flat closure, double mastectomy. I was thrilled.
Yeah, in your blog, you explain a lot about this, Mandy, because on your blog, you talk about it a lot more. And of course, there's much more to it.
Absolutely, yes.
In a poem you wrote after your diagnosis, you called the breast with the cancer a sponge of stored up regret and heartache.
Mm.
Do say more about that.
So in my exploring of emotions, spirituality, and how they affect your body, of course, I came across Gabor Mate, who wrote that book, When the Body Says No. And I started to think about my heart and how for a lot of my life I had felt very homesick, you know, that very, very sad feeling in your heart. I just always felt homesick. And I think I didn't value myself. I'd been in survival mode, desperate when I was in Pretoria for true love. And I was sure that, you know, that soul mate and that partner would be there and then everything would be okay. But often I was cheerful and I felt like my heart under that left breast had just couldn't cope with all of it, you know, and it sort of poured all of that anguish and aching into that breast somehow, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You also told me, and I quote, "Losing my breasts and hair liberated me in a way I would never have expected," which is closely linked to what you said about requesting a very flat breast. How did the loss of your breasts and hair liberate you?
So when I got the diagnosis and I realized what my options were, I was terrified. I mean, there were dark nights and I cried and I panicked and I live on my own and I felt like I was just falling down a black hole. I was really, really terrified. I mean, to lose your nipples and your breasts, I mean, what would happen to me? I would never have a partner again, you know. I would never be sexually active again. I would never look the same. I wouldn't be feminine. What would happen? I would be terrible. I would be a freak, blah, blah, blah. Before the fact, the moment I woke up from that operation, I felt so free. And it was almost like what I had been taught to be, which was all about my look. The look was important. You must have your hair done nicely. You must look right. I was objectified as a woman. I was tall. I'm 6 foot. You know, my dad used to measure me and say, "You're going to be Miss South Africa." I had a Barbie doll, and that was, you know, my image that I sort of thought would be fantastic. And, you know, I would be put on diet and I would be watched and photographed and all sorts. And it's almost as if all of that pressure just fell off me. And it was the most liberating feeling. In the first weeks of chemo, my hair started to come off in clumps. And I stood and looked at myself in the mirror, and I thought, okay, you know that this is going to happen. So I started to shave it off, and I used some mohair, and I got a completely bald head, and I sent the picture to my children, and I said, there you go. And I almost felt like at last I was free. So during my childhood years, and even in my flat before I got to Morag, when I was really depressed and felt like I was a horrible person or I wanted to punish myself, I would cut chunks out of my hair.
Mm.
Or I would just cut a fringe so short that it looked ridiculous. And I would have these chunks cut out, and then I would try and cover them up later. And I knew that it was coming from a strange place of trauma, you know, but I always felt very relieved once I'd cut a few chunks off and my base was full of hair. And when I had no hair, there was no pressure. I felt like I'm still the same. I still feel feminine. I still look at a guy and go, oh, he looks good, you know. Yeah. And this surprised me. And I think that's where the liberation came in, is that I realized that me wasn't the outer shell, me was inside. Mm. And I was still as strong, even stronger, you know. And then I joined a group of women who, unbeknown to me, were all flatties. They're all in America. Oh. Nobody from South Africa. There's a huge group on Facebook of flat closure ladies. And they take stands and they have walks because they want the flat closure to be an option that's acceptable by the surgeons. So a lot of the surgeons, you know, don't say, oh, yes, let's give you – there are four options. You can have prosthetics, you can have this, you can have that, or you can have flat closure. That's not really an option. In America, some of the doctors actually request their breast cancer ladies go for a psychiatric evaluation if they want to become flat and take everything off. Interesting.
Mm. Now, I want to ask you, and I'm referring to the period when you knew you had breast cancer and when you were having the operation and having treatment. Who sustained you?
Well, first of all, you know, as one does, I went to my mom, and my mom and sister and I sat in her patio room and we had a good cry and you know, and got all those emotions out. But my children are just absolutely my heroes. And my eldest son is a gentle giant, and he just phoned me and just covered me in kindness. And my daughter came with me to the first consultation where the lady was telling me about the chemo. So this was after the operation. And the lady was telling me about, you know, if you need social help or social worker. And I was going, no, I don't need any help. This is fine. I know what this is about. And she pointed to my daughter, and I turned and I looked at my daughter, and she was crying. And I thought, sure, this also is not only about me, you know. And then my middle son, who's in Joburg, came to fetch me after the op. And he went with me into the bathroom, and I said to him, just take a photo of me with these tapes on. And it was so interesting because I could take my top off, and he took a photo, and I put my top back on. The strange feeling of lifting my top before, which wouldn't have been appropriate, and now he's taking a photo of these strips over these, you know, scar lines. And then he actually came with me to my mum's house and spent 4 days with me there, and we chatted about everything. We chatted, we cried, you know. And we spoke about everything that presented itself, life, death, men, women, you know, how one presents oneself. And my friends, I have beach friends that I meet at the beach and that swim in the sea every single day. And they were just so supportive. Everyone rallied. Just really, really very beautiful to see.
Mandy, you have spoken about the freedom, the liberation you experienced. Were there other things you learned during this period?
Yes, Mariette, I learned that I had to take responsibility for who I am. You know, I was pointing fingers yin and yang, excuse me now to put in a little Afrikaans phrase, but I was pointing fingers. I mean, I could, you know, there was trauma, there was blame, I could point fingers. And I just realized the minute I take responsibility for who I am now, not for what happens, not for what happened, but for who I am right now, for what you become after adversity. Because you can become fearful, you can choose what you become. And actually it was then up to me. And there is always a choice, you know. And when you do take responsibility, the only problem with that is, and you've got to be very prepared for that, is you make decisions about your life, about your breasts, about how you want to live and where you want to live. And you get pushback. And you have to be really, really solid, you know, in making those decisions. And then be able to present yourself and say, this is what I'm doing, without having to explain. And I just realized that nothing that I lost physically can change who I was. And the other thing was the isolation. So I'm in a flat on my own. And when I first moved into this flat, very, very tiny, I was a bit claustrophobic. And I got the breast cancer diagnosis, and I felt like this was going to be my coffin. This tiny little room, one space, studio flat. I was very dark before, and I just thought, this is going to be my coffin. And I thought, all right, that's okay. I had some amazing spiritual experiences, you know, when I was doing my praying and meditation. I collected little bits and pieces, little statues of the seven stages of woman. And so I was really going deeply inward and doing a lot of spiritual work. And then one day I laughed because I love the queens. I love Cleopatra, and Queen of Sheba, Queen of Persia, and how they link, and then how the, you know, how they all link into the Bible and Solomon and all of that. And I sort of thought one day, well, this could actually, like, Cleopatra be my crypt, you know, with all my special little things around me. But what's transpired now is that this flat has actually become my cocoon. And it's about the metamorphosis, you know. And I have to I am changing. And one has to allow that change. And that's the weirdest thing, is that one changes physically and then the spiritual comes and you think, right, I'm going for it. I'm metamorphosing, you know. And literally, if I think of it today, it's like my ribs and my bones are crumbling. But if you want to come out of that cocoon as a butterfly, you have to allow that. You know, and it's not without a struggle, you know. But there's victory. There's victory.
Yeah, that's a beautiful metaphor, and it links to my next question, which is, what did you let go of during this time?
I think, first of all, I forgave myself. That's a huge one. I think having guilt and self-condemnation and judgment just pulls one down. And I had to really forgive myself and stop feeling guilty for the things I had done because I had been hurt. You know how the cycle goes around. I also lost my need to please others. And I really started to be able to say no gently. From a place in my solar plexus where your self-confidence and your seat of power is, to be able to tell someone the truth and say no without hurting them, because I would just have a little knife and I would be cutting because of my reactionary behavior. I would hurt somebody. And I've really learned to release myself from the responsibility of anything that happened, forgive myself, but now, you know, be truthful and honest. And that was fantastic as well, just realizing that one can be forgiven.
Yeah, that is a huge one. I wanted to ask you, in February 2023, before your diagnosis with bone cancer, you started seeing Morag Skordalis, that we've been talking about, for brain working recursive therapy. Could you tell the listeners how you see it and how you've experienced it?
Well, to put it in one short sentence, Morag is absolutely one of my angels. I'd been to my doctor after the breast cancer. I was coming right. I was walking. I was back to my normal life. And I was feeling great. I was fit. I was walking to Musenberg and back. And I went to my doctor for a chest infection. And she just looked at me and she said, "What is going on? There's a lot of anxiety in your body." And she asked me a few very pointed questions, and I had a panic attack right there. I triggered in her office. And to this day, I'm so grateful that that happened. And everything just came boiling out. And she said to me, "There's a lady I want you to see." And I went to Morag, and on the first day, I sat in her chair, and she was so kind. And I could just feel her acceptance and her love. And it just, my whole story just poured out, and I was shaking. I triggered myself again. I was blood red in the face, and I was totally manic. And she was watching my hands and watching my body and making notes and making notes. And it was almost as if I couldn't stop because of my whole life story just came flooding out. I've done cognitive therapy, hypnotherapy. I've done ayahuasca ceremonies, I've done rape counseling, I've done Reiki. But this one, the brain working recursive therapy, was the one that really got to the root of my issues. Can I tell you what those were?
Yes, please.
Okay, so I would always encounter bullies and I would always react in the normal trigger way. So the bully comes along. He bullies you or she bullies you, and I just trigger, you know, your cognitive brain gets cancelled out and you just react and you either run or you're in this trigger mode for a day or two and you're not really functioning properly. I always felt the heartache, like the homesick feeling in my heart, and I had an extremely low self-esteem, which presented precociously and in attention-seeking as very confident and a bit loud, because I was sort of always making a point. After about, it probably took 10 to 12 sessions of chatting and Morag spotting and making her decision, and we dealt with the bully trigger. The big one was abandonment. And of course, when one thinks about trauma in your life, one goes to the obviously traumatic incidents that happened that you go, "Oh, that happened 10 years ago and that happened 20 years ago and that happened." But we know that from 1 to 7 in those formative years, I mean, that's where those big cockroaches sit, you know. And I've been unpeeling this onion for so many years, and we dealt with the abandonment and neglect. And the day that Morag said, "Right, let's do this work now." And I'm not quite sure of the details, but she asks you some questions and then diverts your attention and asks you some more. Anyway, we did a visualization of what the abandonment looked like. And I think in the session, she said, "Okay, let's take this off you." Or the vision in my mind was, it was sitting on my head, which was like a cow pat, as stinky as a cow pat, and really fresh, you know, abandonment sitting on top of my head. And when we had dealt, the moment I felt that cow pat coming off my head, my whole body was tingling from my toes. I actually started rubbing my legs and my arms and my chest and scratching my head. It felt as if a plant had literally been pulled out from the top of my head. You know, all those tiny little filament roots that come out. And it felt ticklish like that, you know, all the way from my toes. And I got the image of the three medical men And you have one with a skeletal system standing naked and one with a muscular system standing naked, and the other one has got the nervous system. And if I think now of how that felt, it felt as if every nerve in my body had been affected and touched by this root that was now being removed. I have never looked back. The changes were so deep that I had to literally take a bit of time to get used to what was happening. I wrote some things down. I had a look at it. I wrote a lot of poetry. And it was life-changing, absolutely life-changing.
Yeah. Yeah. Just as an aside, I will insert, say, two links into the podcast notes, which explain brain-working recursive therapy, where I spoke to experts. But it certainly sounds as if this changed your whole life when I listened to you.
It was the initial. You know, I see it as a magnet. And as you grow up, you believe lies and you have, let's say you have an abandonment, and it becomes a little magnet. And then you go through your life and all the little iron filings come and stick to the magnet, assuring you that this is true, you know, and confirming this belief, this lie that you've believed. And often I felt that I went to therapists and hypnotherapy and we got rid of the filaments, but we never got rid of the magnet. You see what I'm saying? And so I have no magnet to that anymore. And in Pretoria, where I was looking for love in all the wrong places, having a faulty magnet was a disaster, you know, because it just played into everything. My whole psyche was off.
That's a very striking way to explain it.
Yeah.
Now we're moving to December 2023, when you experienced severe health challenges, which finally transpired to be bone cancer. Can you tell us how this happened?
Well, in December 23, I was sitting on the beach, actually, and I was waiting for a lovely three-week holiday from work. You know, the year end had come, and now I was going to relax for 3 weeks. And I woke up on the first day of my leave, and I thought, oh, this is fantastic. And here we go, I'm going to have a big sneeze. And you know how sneeze for me is so delicious, when you squeeze your nose and you take it into your body and it just gives you that rush. And I sneezed and I felt a jolt of pain in my back. I couldn't believe it. The pain was there and it was from this forward rounding motion. And I almost think I could hear a snap. But, you know, I didn't register it at the time. Anyway, I lay on my bed and I was crying and I definitely could not move. Phoned a friend. Her and her boyfriend came in, and by hook or by crook, in some manner of cripple walking, I got to her car and I was hanging in her car by those handles in the back of her car, and we went to the doctor. The doctor gave me a huge shot and it immediately started to subside, and she gave me a lot of pills and said, 5 days on your back, do not move. I've given you all the stuff that you need to take for something that you've maybe pulled up. She checked down my spine. There was nothing out of the ordinary. So after a while, I tried to get up and I was just in pain every single day. After about 3 weeks, and I was supposed to go back to work, I went back and I said, you're right, let's do everything. I'm worried about maybe, you know, metastasizing to my gallbladder, because my ribs on the right-hand side were aching. And I said, you're under my ribs here. It felt a bit strange because nothing that specific, but then I had all this pain in my torso. We did the x-rays. We did, a scan. We did all of the investigative things, but I couldn't afford a CT scan. So I said, all right, that's fine. And she gave me another lot of pills and said, all right, let's see how it goes. After another 3 weeks of pills, I just was too embarrassed to go back to her, because I thought, I feel so stupid, you know. I mean, how come this pain's not going? I went to the local hospital, which was actually very good for me, because I realized I was terrified to go and sit in the queue with everybody else. And I dealt with that, and it was a wonderful experience sitting in those queues, sharing our salty cracks, all the ladies and the goggles and the old men, all sharing their food and sharing knickknacks, and it was wonderful. But they did exactly the same tests that I had done before. And she'd given me exactly the same pile of medication. Anyway, I carried on like that, and one morning my son phoned me. And he said, Mom, and I just burst out crying. And he said, Mom, I can't believe it. You know that you have had this pain for 6 months.
Oh.
And he said, you've got to do a CT scan. So my bones were already compromised in December
23. Sure.
This was in June. And he said, I'm calling Daniela, who works in the center of town. And it was pitch dark outside. I mean, it was winter. So she had already got to work in the dark, and she was at my house in 35 minutes against the traffic. And she said, Mom, what's going on? And she said, right, let's go. And off we went to Constantiaburg. We had to sit in the emergency room, and the doctor came and said, what's wrong? And again, very strange symptoms. I'm sore. My body is sore. My blood pressure, though, told the story of the pain. I mean, my blood pressure was sky high. And he said, oh, my word. We've got to get this blood pressure done. This is about to explode. Anyway, he sort of frowned and said, all right, he's not sure. And he said, you have to have a CT scan. I said, I can't afford a CT scan. My daughter said, Mom, you're having a CT scan. We'll pay for it. I said, all right. So in we go to have the CT scan. He comes back and he looks at me and says, right, well, we found the origin of your pain. And I said, oh, thank goodness. Can we do something about it? So he said, unfortunately, you have significant breast cancer metastasized to the bones. He said, it's from on your skull, on your cervical vertebrae, in the neck, your right shoulder, down your whole spine, all of the ribs, hence the pain on my torso underneath that I think was the gallbladder, on your pelvis, and at the top of the trochanter. It's sitting there as well. So, of course, there was just the silence. And I looked at my daughter and I said, well, this is it. It's an endgame cancer. I mean, you know that if you get breast metastasized to anywhere, I mean, it's a secondary, you're not going to get rid of it. I just said to her, well, that's it. You know, and you were crying. She phoned my son, who works in gardens in Woodstock. And him and his wife came over immediately and they sat with me and we had a long chat about it. I phoned my other son. And they said, listen, that T11 is cracked on your thoracic spine. I said, oh, now I know when that happened. Yeah, in December. So they said, we have to have an emergency MRI. They phoned the lady in Bishop Lavis, I think, to come back to the hospital, and I had an MRI, an emergency MRI at office 10 that night. The neurosurgeon arrived, the oncologist arrived. The neurosurgeon said to me, have you had a huge accident? It looks like you've been hit by a bus. And I said, no. I said, you know, I've had a few car accidents when I was young, but I mean, that was 40 years ago. And he just said, I actually can't believe that you're sitting upright in this bed on your hips, you know, on your pelvis. And he said to me, if those little bones in your pelvis start disintegrating, whatever, you may become incontinent. So get your children to buy you some nappies. And it involves everything. So you can't compress. So your bowels are also in the picture. And he said, so, okay, let's organize that just in case. And I said, all right, that's fine. Off we go to the ward. And I was feeling very hot, and I think I was a bit in shock. And, you know, shock is an amazing thing. It actually just lifts you off of reality for a bit. And they booked me into the ward at midnight. And then my kids said goodbye. And they made me a salmi and a cup of tea, and they were so, so, so sweet. They were just amazing. They were angels. And then I stayed in hospital to try and get on top of the pain. and bring my blood pressure down. And then also I asked them, please, if I could stay in hospital for radiation. And we tried to motivate because I was really panicking. I felt like I couldn't breathe, and they motivated to keep me, and I had radiation in the hospital, which was absolutely fantastic. I'm forgetting what the question was. I got involved.
Yeah, I was asking how it happened, and you have told us now. So what I'd like to know is, where did it go from being in hospital then?
So when I was in hospital, obviously everybody said, all right, now we've got to make decisions and plans and, you know, where are you going to live? What are you going to do? And I said, I'm living at home. And they're, oh, no, you can't live on your own. And I just said to them, you know what? My house is tiny. I can sit on one chair. I can move to the little couch. I can move to my bed. I know my home. Please, I need to go home and I need to be on my own and I need to just handle this thing, you know, and go inward a little bit. So my son came down from Joburg and the children organized my will. We went over the will. We went over all the other options. You know, do I go to some facility where I can get looked after? I said, well, not yet. I'm still fine and I can still walk. They bought me a walker. I was told not to drive. The company I was working for brought me a shower chair, which was fantastic because every time I showered, I wanted to faint. And so they brought me this beautiful shower chair and I sat to shower and everything was in place as far as it could be. And then I started the chemo pills. So I wasn't going to have chemo because there's no, well, I would say that rather than having, quoting the doctor, there was no point in doing chemo. You know, and you can't radiate every single vertebrae and you can't fix this. It's not curable. And so we can do what we can do. And the next option was these chemo pills. So my children took it on themselves to actually pay this 15,000 rand a month for this wonder drug, which wasn't covered by the medical aid. After 4 months of taking the drug, which made me obviously very, very nauseous, and I kept fainting every time I went to the beach. I was very, very faint. I would carry salt with me and I'd carry a Coke with me, and I would, you know, have to be extremely careful. And my eyes would track, so I would look across my room and I felt like a little fly was buzzing after my every look I gave, and I felt like my room was full of threads, like black filaments. And I realized that actually only happened an hour after I took the chemo pills. So it was the chemo pills. So I thought, all right, that's fine. There's a logical explanation. But after 4 months of the chemo pills and paying that money, I just thought, you know, I actually don't see the point of striving. You know, you go through a stage where you say, I'm going to fight this. And I got to the realization that no. My belief had changed, in that this was my journey and I will walk my journey. I knew that I was protected and covered by the angels. I knew that I was supported by the universe. I was in touch with Source. I was doing lots of meditation. Archangel Michael was there when I did my meditations. In my MRI, I called on Saint Germain, and I was lying under the MRI, and as it was cluck, 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 clucking going through, I was completely calm, and the message I kept getting was, there are no mistakes. There are no mistakes. For 40 minutes, there are no mistakes. And it calmed me down so much, and it was amazing. So, at some point I felt throughout my life is over. So I thought of all the death options, you know, and made plans and said to my children, if I become incapacitated, this is what I'm going to do. And I don't want to become a burden and go from a wheelchair to the bed and a wheelchair to the bed if, let's just say, I had a stroke, you know. So I got a general directive, and I actually have filled out forms that my children have in the case of that. So there is an option that one has, and it's called the VSED program, which is voluntarily stopping eating and drinking. Now, if a person is actually terminal at that end phase of your life, you're not going to feel like eating. And often terminal patients say, I don't want to eat. And so there is a practitioner that I spoke to, and she would come then and be with me and support me in that end of life sort of decision. But before I get even there, you know, there are those nights that you lie and you think, you know, I've got a whole packet of oxycodes or the, you know, the morphine derivatives. You know, I could just pour them into a glass, throw away the capsule, because I wouldn't want anybody to think I would actually take my life, and then just fall asleep and not wake up. And that was a very tough night. But when I woke up in the morning and the sun shone through my window, I thought to myself, if death is inevitable, let's take death and stop looking at it and obsessing about it and push, like a sliding scale, just push that death to the side, because it's going to happen and you have no control of how it's going to happen. Then I phoned my children and I said to them, listen, I just want to tell you right now that if somebody comes to my flat, some of them have got keys, and I'm non-responsive, I have not committed suicide. I will not do that to you. If I feel I can't cope anymore, I will tell you I can't cope. And you are going to have to be strong enough to then say, okay, Mom, next step, and we'll hold your hand. You know what I'm saying? Mm. I did not want to leave them with that query, because the chance was that I could have a heart attack because the chemo pulls drew from your heart. And so I had to have the ECG before I took the pills, and then after the first month, just to check that it wasn't affecting my heart too much and that I could carry on with those pills. But I just wanted to make it very clear to my children that I would not be taking that option. And I pushed the death query to the side, because that we don't know. And I decided that why not have some fun? Because I've done all these modalities. I've done all these beautiful modalities of healing. I've had wonderful spiritual experiences. My gran has been in my room supporting me and just giving me this loving warmth that stays with me for 3 days afterwards when I'm in a situation and I'm panicking. You know, after my dad died, he presented himself in my room and I could have a discussion with him. And I could have it out with him, and we could hug each other, and I could come to terms with that. So I thought, I'm having all these wonderful experiences. Why not just enjoy the experiences? Because that little rock that I slid over to the side is a given. So let's have fun in the meantime with everything. And then pain comes up, and I think, okay, I'm in pain. And I think to myself, how relaxed is your body? So being a Pilates instructor, I'm very aware of all my muscles and how to isolate and relax your body. Is there fear? And, oh, there it is. There it sits. Just rub out that little bit of fear. And you know that the pain halves when you relax all your muscles, you allow it, you look at it, and you have no fear. Because it's going to happen. It is happening. The facts that I don't have to think, oh, this is weird, or what's happening to me. I know what's happening to me. And so if I have pain, I know if I lie on my back, it will relax. But then I just take off those extra little layers of what adds to pain, fear and questions and the unknown. Mm. You know, I think the most devastating thing was I had lost my breasts and my hair at some point. Now I'm losing my strength. Now this Pilates instructor does a three-tier balancing act can't be up for more than 40% of the day. And then I have to take tiny little steps, because if the steps are too big, it pulls too much on my back. Thank you.
A quick note on what I do. I'm a content entrepreneur creating podcasts and articles on living a happier and healthier life by interviewing coaches, therapists, and other wellness experts from over the world. You'll find this content on my website, www.marietsneeman.co.za, and it's there to help you find just the right helping professional when you need one. The section Up Close and Personal on my website offers you a glimpse of the person behind many of the experts I feature. If you're a wellness expert keen on getting more in-person or online clients, or creating worldwide awareness of an issue close to your heart, let's talk about co-creating a podcast or article, or perhaps featuring you in a South African magazine. You'll find more information under Services on my website. To each listener, no matter your age, occupation, or where you live, how about creating your very own personal audio recording with me as a one-of-a-kind gift to someone you deeply care for? In this private interview with me, you can share childhood memories with your children or grandchildren, record a bird's eye view of your career or business, or speak about an unforgettable trip. The possibilities are endless. To find out more, just click on Gift Podcasts on my website. Now, back to my guest. Difficult, I suppose. You're not working because you cannot work, right?
Well, I'm 63 and I stopped working. In fact, I stopped working before I had the diagnosis. I was so uncomfortable and ratty. I couldn't sit still. And I just thought, you know what? What would be my biggest joy right now? Disregarding the fact that I haven't got an income and I don't have any money, I thought to myself it would be just to resign. I can't do this anymore. Anyway, I resigned and we went through all the hospital period and the chemo pills and all of that. And a friend of mine said to me, you're going to have to apply for SASSA. And the next morning she said, no, I've got a better idea. I think you should apply for UIF. I said, I just can't. I actually just don't have the emotional strength to now try and deal with, you know, departments. And she said, I will be your broker. And she got all my paperwork and I got UIF for 6 months, which was absolutely fantastic. Last week, I was at Weinberg to fill out all my SASSA papers. So I've actually got an appointment in May to finish off my SASSA application. But yes, I have my own little flat, which is the cheapest thing to live in. It would make no sense to sell it and move. And I've got my motor car. You know, so my next step would probably be to sell the motor car. And I sort of think to myself, you know, it's fine. It's all about letting go. And every time I think, well, okay, if tomorrow you pass over and you join all your angel friends, what would the car matter? And then immediately it drops off me and I think, oh, it's just an attachment. Just let it go. So I am now open to all options. And it's a good feeling. It is a very, very good feeling. It's extremely freeing because you just go within and live that away to the outside. And actually whatever you need will be provided. Whatever you need will be provided. And it just, I know that now. And I can relax.
Yeah, Mandy, what a journey. I think, please just tell people where they can go to your blog, because it is absolutely chock full of wonderful things. Where can they find it?
So the blog I started writing when I moved to Pretoria. So it was all about the journey of finding myself and starting a new life. And it's www.thelifeofmgm.blogspot.com. If they can't find it, then they can always email me and I can send a link. It's not a problem. And it's mandymulders@gmail.com.
Well, I will attach that link to the podcast itself.
Fantastic.
So it will be in the podcast notes. And also, if people listen on Spotify or Google Podcasts or any of those platforms, they will find the link there as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I feel very excited that, you know, I've written a book. I've got 38,000 words of the old life, the childhood, and the marriage. But it's sitting there looking at me, and I think to myself, you know, does one want to write about the initial part, the traumatic? And
yes.
I think, you know what, it's not actually even necessary for me. I can let it all go. You know, and that's amazing.
That is.
There's no blame. There's no judgment. Everyone has their journey. And, you know, we all do things the best we can at the moment, and we've all got triggers and we've all got trauma. And I think when one can understand that of every person you come into contact with, then a lot is forgivable and you can just let it go because you do understand, you know.
Indeed. To conclude, could you please read us your poem, Follow Your Heart?
Certainly. Follow your heart. That's all there is. Sometimes there's resistance. Some won't understand. But close your eyes and look inward. Your gut feel is real. Not your hunger or your want, but a deep sense of what you need to do next. Rest quietly there for a bit in the knowledge that you are loved, and walk gently into the unfolding.
Ah, thank you, Mandy. Thank you for this honest discussion, which I found deeply moving. And thank you for, I could almost say, for being a shining light to many others.
Thank you, Mariette. This has been a great privilege and a great gift. Thank you.
And to our listeners, it was good of you to join us. If you found this episode inspiring, please share it with someone you care about. Go to my website, www.marietsneeman.co.za, for this episode's podcast notes and for free podcasts and articles on how to live a happier and healthier life and have more fulfilling relationships. To follow me on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn, just search for Mariette Sneeman Journalist. The podcast series, Calm, Clear, and Helpful, is produced by me with original music by Mart Marie Sneeman. Catch you next Tuesday at 9:00.